and it's my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Okay, when I first met Mike, he sucked me in into work service right away. I wasn't even like a month old when he was like, hey, you want to come and greet us at your Valley Group speaker meeting? And so that's one of the things that I became his friend, you know, right away with. He made little batches with our names, and it was so special. And I thought, you know, he was such a cool person. And he's been a very good friend from day one that I walk into this room. He is from Visalia, and he celebrated his 29 years of sobriety on January the 2nd. So please, please give him a big hand so he can share his story with us. Thank you.
Hi everybody, I'm Mike, alcoholic. A real alcoholic, the kind my ex-wives talk about. You know, I used to, a long time ago, I haven't heard this for a while, but there was always people that would, or some people that would say, I'm whoever and I'm an alcoholic, a real alcoholic, the kind the big book talks about. I like to change it just a little bit. It fits better with me this way. I learned a new prayer the other day, and it fits me. I don't know if it fits anybody else, but it fits me, so this is going to be a real short talk. And the prayer goes, God, fill my mouth with worthwhile stuff and shut it when I've said enough. So I'm Mike, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 2nd, 1986. And for mathematically challenged people, that's 29 years and 5 days. And I didn't do it. Well, I did do the work, that's true. But it's all because of you guys. It's all because of everybody that was here when I got here. I only know one person in this room that was here when I got here. But that doesn't matter because you're all here. Okay? And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that's embodied in the steps and the 12 traditions has made me a person that I definitely wasn't when I got here. And, well, that sounds good enough. I'll see y'all later. I brought my big book, and you know they say if your big book's falling apart, you normally aren't, and my big book's definitely falling apart. This is the one I got when I was, about 2 weeks sober. It has all kinds of different things highlighted and circled and underlined and now, not later, and three phases of our illness and all kinds of stuff. And I want to share with you real quick the end of, kind of the end of my drinking. I didn't drink much in high school because I went through a process that they used to do for alcoholics that they don't do anymore because they found out it doesn't work. It was called the aversion therapy. It's behavior modification. What it is they stick, Jim, you might remember that, huh? You know, the old timers, when I got here, they used to talk about it. They even had a place up in Kingsburg. And they'd stick you in a place and they would just keep filling you with alcohol. And, you know, and you get sick. And then they'd fill you with more alcohol and you'd be getting sick. And, you know, for an alcoholic, that doesn't work because my drink of choice was more.
Right.
You know? I mean, that was my drink of choice. It was more. And all these old-timers said it didn't work for them either. You know, but I accidentally, when I was about 14, did aversion therapy on myself. I always wanted to drink like my dad. My dad was a drinker, and he loved drinking whiskey and, you know, other things, but whiskey was his big thing, and I wanted to be like my dad. So I would steal a little tiny bit of this whiskey so he wouldn't notice it and put it in this jar and stick it outside. And I did this for, I don't know, 3 months or so, you know. And then one day my parents were gone, and the neighbor kid and I drank that whiskey because we wanted to see what it was like, okay. And And I immediately liked the effect produced by alcohol. I mean, I'd been drinking some here and there, and I always liked the effect, but kind of got pretty sick and kind of got kind of weird that night, because I found out later, I didn't think about it till I got sober, but that was a quart mason jar of whiskey is what it was for two of us at 14 years old. So I kind of didn't drink a lot. I drank beer sometimes when I was in high school, but the thing about it is, you know, we talk about an alcoholic being an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And I went to a little country school. It's not a country school anymore. It's Mineral King School. But it was way outside of town when I was growing up. And I came to the big school of Mount Whitney High School. Yeah. Ooh, big city, right? And I had the absolute necessity to fit in. You know, a lot of my friends had gone to Redwood. A lot of my other friends were in different classes. We didn't hang out together. I had to find something to be able to fit in. And as it turned out, it was those other things, other than alcohol, that I used to fit in. I learned how to use it to fit in. And I got to the point where I noticed that these guys that were, you know, people that were, I could fit in with these other people that were doing these other things, you know, other than drinking so much. And, but I also found out that the guys that were producing them for people were really important people. And I wanted to be important. I wanted to be important. I wanted to fit in. And so I started doing those things. When I was in high school, basically for a while, I was a junior produce dealer and a junior pharmacist. And figure that out. It'll take a second, okay? And I used to love it, man, when people would come and stick money in my face. And I was a sneaky bastard. You know, I never did get caught, but I found out when I was about a junior in high school that the state of California had my parents' phone tap. My dad found about that. He didn't like that at all. You know, he didn't like that at all. And I have three sisters, and my younger sister knew that I was getting close to getting in big trouble. You know, I was pretty sneaky. I was real sneaky. You know, that's all there is to it. I was just real sneaky. And so she called my older sisters, and they had a conversation, and my younger sister busted me to my dad. And he didn't find much because I was sneaky. I didn't keep anything at home, but he found a little bit. And so basically I kind of quit doing that. As far as being the salesman, you know, but I still didn't quit using it. But I was such a good kid. I mean, I was such a wonderful kid, you know, that when I graduated from high school, you know, and that's the one thing that no matter what, for some reason it was ingrained in myself and a whole bunch of other people that I went to high school with, is no matter what you do out there, you graduate from high school. And I did. I don't know how, but I did. And for my graduation from high school, my parents gave me a one-way ticket to Hawaii. And yeah, it wasn't two-way, it was one-way. And I supposedly had a friend there, and I, you know, I got there off the plane, and he said, oh, I forgot, I was meaning to call you. Because in those days, you didn't have cell phones, and you didn't call because it was expensive. We wrote back and forth, because he said he had a job and a place to stay and stuff. And he goes, well, I lost my job and your job along with it, and we don't have a place to stay. We got this abandoned house we could stay in. I was 18, I said, hey, I got $100 in my pocket, man. We're here, I'm here, you know. And so I did. I stayed in Hawaii for 3 years. I got a job with a carnival. Got to travel all around. And I learned how to drink the right way. You know, one of the first things we did after that state fair that I started working at was we took a vacation carnival to Hilo, to the Big Island. And my boss told me, we're going to go out drinking with the Ride Boys. And the Ride Boys were a bunch of Samoan gentlemen, and they were big. He said, you want them to be your friends. Okay? The smallest one was 6'2" and weighed 250 pounds, and he was a year younger than me. You know, I mean, these guys were huge. And so I bought him a couple rounds of Primo at the local bar. That's Hawaiian piss water. And they were friends. Michael, you good Holly boy. That's what they used to always call me. Michael, you good Holly boy. And, you know, so I did do that. And I learned how to sit in basically by, you know, buying drinks for the guys and stuff like that. And I didn't really, I didn't have any blackouts. I kind of was a normal drinker, not always, but I don't want to go into those stories. It's too long. But we also had things that kept us awake, because during the carnival, sometimes we'd work 23, 24 hours a day at a big carnival. And so we had other things that kept us awake, and it can keep you drinking. Okay? So, we got done with all that, and I went back to Hawaii. You know what? I forgot to record this. Oh well. Anyway, got, you know, I went back, I got done with Hawaii. It was expensive. In 1973, the gasoline was 50 cents a gallon there. It was expensive. Everything was expensive there. And my girlfriend and I wanted to travel around the country. We came back to California and traveled around the country. Gas was 25 cents a gallon then. It cost from going from San Diego to Beaufort, South Carolina, $76 in gas. Yeah. Anyway, it was when I got back is when I learned, is when I started drinking really heavy. Is I ended up working where I worked for 26 years out at Jostens as a printer, and I worked the graveyard shift, which was 11 at night, 7 in the morning. And I had myself convinced, this is the alcoholic in me, I had myself convinced that I was an insomniac, so I had to drink myself to sleep every day. You know, I mean, that's what I had to drink myself to sleep every day. And I remember, one thing I remember one time was sitting on the side of the bed with a big old half gallon of vodka, drinking it straight, thinking, I wonder if this is right. You know? I wonder if it, nah, it's fine. You know, it's fine because, you know, Dr. Silkworth says in our book, the only, our only life that we know is drinking. You know, and for me, is I like the effects produced by alcohol, and it wasn't just sleeping. You know, I like, I'm the same way with coffee nowadays. I don't like the taste of coffee, but I love the effect it produces. It wakes me up in the morning. You know, and that's what it was alcohol made me feel good. And so I did that for a few years. I got married, and then I got unmarried. And then it really took off. It really took off pretty good. And the last couple years of my drinking, now the last 6 years of my drinking, I worked the perfect drinking shift out of Jostens. It was three in the afternoon to 11 o'clock at night. Okay, you get off at 11 o'clock at night, you can drink all night long. And I had buddies that we would go over to somebody's house one day and shoot pool and drink, or actually drink and shoot pool. And one night go over to somebody's house and shoot craps and drink and shoot craps. You know, and that kind of stuff. But the last 2 years of my drinking, I couldn't do that. I couldn't go over to those guys' house and just have fun, you know, because I would have to share my alcohol with them. My alcohol and whatever else that I took that I needed to get myself where I needed to get. And, you know, that's the way it was. And I didn't realize until I got sober what a lonely life that was. You know, and gosh, to put it as nicely as I can, I had become a hater. You know, and it says in the book, lack of power, that was our dilemma, that we had to find a power greater than ourselves. I just hated everybody. I hated you guys, if you were born then, if you're over 29, just because nobody in the world would do anything I want them to do. I had no idea what I wanted people to do, but I still, people wouldn't do things. Right, for me. Selfishness, self-centeredness, this we think is the root of our problem. Okay? And I really, really was like that, and it got to the point, this is going to talk about the last of my drinking. I don't know, July, August, September of the year before I got sober, this is 85, I'd get home from work, I would get my assault rifle out. I had an assault rifle with 30-round clip. My wife at the time, my second ex-wife, and her kids would all be asleep, and I would sit in the living room, and we had a screen door and then a door. And I lived down by Jefferson Park, which wasn't the best neighborhood in the world. Jefferson Park over by Whitney, and you know, there was those scum people that lived down there, you know, all those dirty old heroin addicts and stuff. And it didn't matter that I used to sell to heroin addicts when I was in high school, but that's the way I felt. And I just wanted to kill somebody. So I would open that door at night just a little bit with that screen door closed, and I'd have that door open, and I'd have that assault rifle next to me so that somebody could, you know, see, oh, somebody left their door open, and they'd break into my house and I could kill them. That's what I wanted to do. That's the kind of person I had become. And you know, I shared it before, when I got here, I shaved in the shower all the time, every day. You know, I'd get in the shower and shave before I went to work. You know, I'd get up about 1 p.m. every day. I'd throw up, you know, get in the shower and shave. And the reason I shaved, and this is something I found out through the inventory process, is because I didn't like that guy that was looking back at me in the mirror. You know, I didn't like anybody else. I put up with a lot of people, but I didn't like anybody else, but I also did not like the person that was looking back at me. You know, I really honestly couldn't look at him in the mirror. But I trudged on, and it was not a happy road of destiny. It really wasn't a happy road of destiny. And the end of my drinking, the very end of my drinking was December 31st, 1985. I had a party at my house because people wouldn't invite me to parties anymore. And because of my actions, I was a blackout drinker, by the way. Definitely a blackout drinker. And my drinking buddies that I drank with would always, ha ha, Michael, you had such a great time. It was, oh, look at, oh, what you did, ha. And last party was at my house, and I was going to try and do the things like it talked about in chapter 3. I only bought beer. I was going to drink beer only. And then somebody come over with a bunch of whiskey. So much for that. Right? And I was going to limit the number of drinks. Well, that didn't happen either. And so, you know, we had a party. We had a good time, I guess. I don't know. I blacked out early. And we ended up over somebody else's house who had a hot tub. And you know, we had, I guess we had some fun in the hot tub. I don't remember. I do remember the last thing I drank, at least I went out in style. The last thing I drank was a magnum of champagne. You know, and the next thing I remember is I was driving home. So actually, I didn't think I was driving home. I thought a buddy of mine that was staying at my house was driving home, because I remember looking out the driver or the passenger side window saying, to hell with those people if they don't know how to have a good time. You know? And I got up the next day and went over to their house to get my own pants, because I'd gone home with somebody else's pants on. And they had fit. so I don't know, but they weren't my pants. And, you know, those drinking buddies that had always laughed, "Oh, Mike, you had so much fun, it was great," and all this stuff. What they did was they just shook their heads and said, "Mike, you just don't want to know. You just don't want to know." And I said, "Really, come on, we had a good time, right?" And it's just like, "No, you don't want to know." And so I said, "Okay." And the next morning was January 1st. Well, that was January 1st. I kind of didn't feel too well, needless to say. And the next morning, my wife, on January 1st, my wife had said, "I would give my right arm if you'd quit getting drunk like that." Not quit drinking, but quit getting drunk like that. Okay? And it was because of my actions when I drank like that. And so she wrote down the number of the Tulare County Central Office. It was brand new. It was 2 months old at the time. And I called up this old lady, and she was funny. She was weird. And what I had in my head was a plan. Now, I know this hasn't happened to any of you newcomers. And by the way, please, all of you newcomers, all of you guys that are in here, from my heart, I welcome you. And I hope and pray that you get what I got. You know, I really, really do. To me, it was a God thing, but I didn't know anything about God. I mean, God and me weren't on good condition, good even talking conditions at the time. And so she sent out this man to pick me up, and he called me up, and his name was Sailor Ken. Jim remembers him. A few people might. And I figured I was going to learn from those old winos and stuff at AA. I didn't want to learn how to drink like a gentleman so David could take his hat off to me, right? I still wanted to be able to drink like a pig, like I did. But I wanted to learn how to act not so much like a gentleman, but better. Okay? And this guy came and picked me up and took me to my very first meeting. And that very first meeting was at Pine Recovery. They used to have noon meetings there all the time. And all I remember about that meeting is there was this guy with this really, really boisterous voice. And he kept saying, "God has done this for me. God can do this for me. God could and would if he were sought. And God this and God that." That was holy. I didn't realize till later that was holy. Hey, I only was at my first meeting, and I stayed sober anyway. Okay? You know, and the thing is, as I was walking out of Pine, I figured, I can't do this. Me and God just, no, forget it. And I said my first prayer in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't even know I was saying a prayer. I said, "God, what have I got myself into?" And you know, the God that I have today, the God that I have been given by the Educational Variety, that's in the back of our big book here, did for me what I could not do for myself. I was just going to tell Ken, "Oh, I got to go over to the library, Ken. I got things to do," and then, because I wasn't going to do this, I said no. And that prayer was answered immediately because Ken put his hand on my shoulder and said, "I want to take you to some place and introduce you to some people." And he took me down to the Alano Club, and there was about four people there. Okay, and these people all smiled at me. And trust me, I wasn't welcome in my own home. I wasn't welcome in my own mind. Smiling at me usually, to me, meant somebody wanted something, you know? But I didn't feel that. I didn't feel that. They said, "Welcome here, and keep coming back." And they shook my hand, and I felt like they really meant it. And I was talking to this little old lady about this tall. Her name was Alice. And she had 100 years sobriety at the time anyway. I love that woman. I really love that woman. And we were talking. I don't remember what we were saying, but I said something to Alice, and she said back to me, "That's okay, honey. We understand." And I didn't realize it at the time that I was hooked. I didn't realize it that 90-day plan was already out the window. And she gave me this. I still have it. It has the Serenity Prayer. It has the steps and the traditions on it. And I still have that to this day. It means a whole lot to me. And so Ken took me to a bunch of meetings. It wasn't about 90 meetings in 90 days. It was about as many meetings as you could get to. I worked swing shifts, so I could only go to noon meetings, and Ken would take me to weekend meetings, too. And he took me to a bunch of different meetings, not just the same meeting where you hear the same thing and all that stuff. But one of the things I noticed was the people there were having fun. The people there were having fun. There was this lady there, you know, who was probably in her 40s. And she said, you know, when she'd share, she'd say, I didn't get here because I burned the carrots when I was cooking. You know, I'm a real alcoholic. And there was this other lady, she lives back east now, we're friends on Facebook still, and she said, she used to do things, they used to do fun things, and these fun things made me want to keep coming back, and I didn't realize it. See, I was still kind of foggy up here, and I'll share that in a minute, but I was foggy up here. When you read chapter 3, it says drinking from scotch to brandy, or switching from scotch to brandy. And I remember her saying a couple times when she'd read chapter 3, switching from scotch to Valium. You know? And I could identify with that. I wish I had an hour. I'd tell you a whole story about that. Anyway, you know, I really started enjoying things. And, you know, I didn't pick up my 30-day chip or my 60-day chip because I was so bent up here. I thought I was fine, but I really was bent up here because I noticed people that in the meetings that got a 30-day or 60-day or 90-day chip, they got called on. And I figured that if I got called on and whatever was going on up here in my head, which was totally, totally insane, came out of my mouth, I would be asked to leave and not come back. And I didn't even realize that, you know, there was people saying all kinds of stuff. Average Dave, who had been a roommate of mine years before, he came in 5 days after me, and Dave talked all the time, and they never asked him to leave. You know, and so, but I heard things. I heard things that were positive, and the people that were having fun, this is for you new people, the people that were having fun, and the people that were, you could tell, were liking sobriety, said things like, I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor who has obviously worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this sponsor helps me do that. Okay, this sponsor helps me do that. So I got a sponsor. Okay, after about 90 days. And I figured I needed somebody that would whip my ass if I didn't, you know, stay in shape. So I got this guy who said he was a former Hell's Angel. I didn't think there was such a thing. And he was a tough guy in the meetings, but you get him in his office, just me and him, and he gently and lovingly walked me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, for the next number of months. And I see I'm running out of time. Just like before. He really did help me. He helped me, and he wanted me to get it. And he really, really helped me get it. And I heard when I was starting to be able to hear things like, people that get into service work, 95% of the people that get into H&I stay sober. And I thought, you know, I'm going to stay sober. So there was this guy, Larry Sloan, he's passed on, and he was a great guy. And he tricked me into doing H&I work. Because he asked me one day, I wanted to do some service work, and he asked me one day, you want to go to a H&I meeting down at Pine? And I said, sure. And I got busy and didn't go, and then he looked me up and said, hey, you didn't make it. And I said, well, I'll make it next week. Okay, fine. So I get into this. I said, I thought it was a big business meeting that I could do envelopes, and I can do this, and I can do that. And I sat down, and there was another gentleman and me and Larry, but then it was all the people from Pine, and I thought, this is kind of strange for a business meeting. I thought it was a business meeting. And so, you know, they're talking and doing this, and all of a sudden Larry goes, "And our speaker today is Mike." And when my jaw got up off the table, I shared the best I could at 8 months sobriety. And you know, 4 months later, I took that meeting into Pine for 2 years. And I did get heavily into H&I. And I did get heavily. I'm the one who got the meetings going out in Corcoran Prison, and I got the meetings started back up out at the jail in the road camp. I was area chairman for H&I, and you know, I've been a DCM, and or an alternate DCM, and I've been a secretary, and I've been all that. And you know, I've made my way up as high as you can go in Alcoholics Anonymous, all the way up to the ladder to a sober member. That's what we all are. That's as high as you get in Alcoholics Anonymous, a sober member. You know, that's what we all are. We are all equal in here. Just wanted to share for the newer people, you know, everything's not perfect when you get sober. Sober stands for son of a bitch, everything's real. S-O-B-E-R. Things are real. I have been divorced twice and married twice with one close call since I got sober. Okay? That woman I got sober for, 2 weeks after my second AA birthday, she said, "I can't be married to you anymore." You know, and the thing was, is I just wasn't controllable anymore. I would go to meetings all the time. I would go to conventions. The first convention I ever went to, and I want to share this with you guys, I will never forget it. It was over at Cal Poly, and Average Dave and I went, and you know, they always have themes at conventions, and their theme was, "I can't, we can." Okay? And that's how it worked for me. Okay? I continually grow and find my higher power in Alcoholics Anonymous through you. I've never had the burning bush. It's never happened. I've waited for it a lot of times, laid in bed. Come on. Come on, God. Come on, talk to me. It doesn't work. What works is when I share with another alcoholic, sharing my experience, strength, and hope, and them sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, there's a lot of things I have in my book that I was going to talk. One of the things is that I have had to learn. One of my favorite sayings in Alcoholics Anonymous is live and let live. And live and let live means, for me, mind your own damn business. You know, because there's so much goes on. I know with you new people, I know that in the houses there's just so much going on. And it's like, live and let live. You know, I never went through a recovery home. I've known so many people who went through a recovery home. I was 12-step, you know. But one of the things it says in the book on page 84, it says, love and tolerance of others is our code. We have to learn how to love each other. You guys had to love me until I could learn to love myself. That's the way it worked for me. And that's the way it still works for me. You know, I had... It's been a rough couple of days for me. I've been fighting the city of Visalia so I could... I've made some really, really fantastic choices in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've made some really dumb choices. I mean, that's the way it works. Son of a bitch, everything's real. And about 14 years ago, I let an oak tree grow in my front yard. My wife said, when it was about this big around, "You better cut it down, you know, before the city won't let you." And that thing's this big around now, and it's right over our sewer line. And I've been fighting the city of Visalia over it and stuff like that. Well, 12 years ago, that was a bad choice, and not cutting that sucker down. I figured, it's going to be okay. Now it's caused a lot of problems, but guess what? You know, I just prayed about it. Plumbers came out today, fixed the thing, and I will go through the city and try and get it cut down and talk to Bill about it. You know, and I've made other fantastic choices. When I was 10 years sober, I went back to college. I worked full-time and went to college full-time for 5 years. And I became a school teacher. Now, for somebody like me... becoming a school teacher is not something that you would think. But the thing is I've always wanted to work with at-risk kids. Because I was an at-risk kid. Right? And I do teach. I teach at a continuation school out in Wood Lake, and this is my 14th year. That's one of the best choices I've ever made. One of the things is, though, I wish I'd made that choice 10 years younger, because I'm 62 and a half years old, and it kicks my ass every day. I come home, and I'm exhausted. That's why I make 3 meetings a week. I make this one, and I have a service commitment here. I make the Sunday morning meeting, and I make the Friday night meeting. You know, and try and make others. Sometimes I make the Saturday night meeting. And it's just because things have happened. You know, I have developed a heart problem in the last year, and it causes me, the medication I have to take causes me to be really, really tired. And so, you know, in the evenings, I'm just kind of dead. You know, not dead, but, you know, exhausted. Exhausted. And the whole thing is I also, there's a lot of people in here. I was looking today at the birthdays, and there's a lot of birthdays of big numbers, big numbers, big numbers, and then they get down, the lowest number is 7. And I thought, man, where are all the 1, 2, 3, 4-year-olds? You know, am I doing something wrong? Are we doing something wrong in here? What do we need to do to keep people coming back? You know, and I have to research that. I have to share that. I have to do whatever I can do to get you to want to stay here. You know, I didn't want to stay here. I had a 90-day plan, and that was 29 years, 5 days ago. You know, because I found something in here. I found a higher power, and I found a person that I like. Okay, I found a person that I can look in the mirror in the morning and she's got my mustache and shave and laugh at her. You goofy sucker, come on, let's go get those kids. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I love this life. I love this life. I am not as much an actor who is self-centered, egocentric, as part, like we call nowadays. You know, I'm going to end with this. This is something I saw on Facebook, and it's really helped me lately with a lot of the stuff that's been going on. Stuff's been going on, and I'm not even thinking about drinking or using drugs. Stuff's going on, and I'm thinking about putting one foot in front of the other. And this thing is, I have on my wall by my computer where I spend a lot of time, it says, get your fire back. It's not over until God says it's over. Start believing again. Start dreaming again. Start pursuing what God put in your heart. God has put love and tolerance of others in my heart, and I need to keep it that way. Thank you for letting me share.